Alrighty there, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Chronicler podcast channel. Now, I did say this last week, and the rule still applies. So, rather than listening to my boring old voice, you're going to hear the voice of my good friend, Michael Buster, and his first episode of the Forgotten Wars podcast. Now, the first episode is about South Africa, so if you've got an interest in South Africa, or even forgotten history for that matter, then by all means, sit back, relax, and enjoy.
This is Forgotten Wars.
Some people I respect a lot told me that I should tell you a bit about me before I ask you to dive into a story with me that will likely take over 30 episodes to tell. I'm a high school world history teacher in Phoenix, Arizona. On this date of October 27th, I am days, maybe hours, from becoming a father for the first time. My hope for Forgotten Wars is to tell true stories of wars that have shaped millions of people, but have been forgotten by many millions more. Not only do I hope you'll better understand your neighbors around the world on a more meaningful level, but I also hope you'll gain a deeper understanding of the wars most of us are already familiar with. There are a couple of ways I'd recommend you join me in this season's story about the Boer Wars. If you are someone who likes to stick to a more chronological order, you're at the right episode. If you are someone like me who loves the director who brought us The Dark Knight, Inception, and Tenet, someone who loves movie director Christopher Nolan's style of storytelling, then start listening at episode 1 and continue working your way through the episodes in number order. Regardless of what you choose, thank you so much for giving Forgotten Wars a chance. The final remark I'll make before this episode really gets going is about the names of these wars we will cover this first of what I hope to be many seasons. I just referred to the wars we will cover this season as the Boer Wars. That is a traditional way that people have referred to them. However, some people refer to the First Boer War that lasted just a few months of 1880 to 1881 as the Transvaal Rebellion. Many people in South Africa take issue with that war being referred to as a rebellion. Many historians over time have referred to the Second Major War that lasted from 1899 to 1902 in a variety of ways. Some call it the Second Boer War, or even just the Boer War. Others have been slightly more comprehensive and have referred to that Second War as the Anglo-Boer War, since it did involve the British as well as the Boers. Who were the Boers? Well, we will get to that soon. Now, more recently, that Second War we will cover this season has been called the South African War. This South African War of 1899 to 1902 is arguably more fitting because it involved far more than just Boers and Brits. Hundreds of thousands of African natives were involved in various ways and ultimately bore the ripple effects of this South African War as much as any group involved. There is a lot more you can read about what these wars should be called and why. But I don't think most of you are here to listen to me talk about that any longer. All that said, for better or worse, I will go back and forth between the different names for these two wars. You will hear me refer to the First Boer War and the Transvaal Rebellion as one and the same war. You will hear me refer to the Second Boer War, the Anglo-Boer War, and the South African War as one and the same. If this offends any of you listening anywhere in Europe, Africa, or academia in general, please know that I mean no offense. Now, let's get to our long, winding story. On October 19th, 1653, a boy named David Jantz was shepherding livestock. David was working for a refreshment post of the Dutch East India Company in the Cape Peninsula. Herders like David maintained livestock, the regular source of meat for the Dutch East India Company's ships docked at Table Bay. Suddenly, some nearby native tribesmen swooped in to steal almost all of the livestock under David's care. The tribesmen murdered David. The Dutch East India Company, the VOC, did not retaliate. Wanachu Maw, the man who led the marauding tribesmen, showed up to the outpost again nearly 2 years later. The commander, John Antonizoon van Riebeck, had not forgotten David Yance's murder. Riebeck bit his lip and accepted all the excuses and apologies offered by Achumaw. The interpreter Toman, maybe sensing weakness, advised nearby tribesmen to steal livestock again from the refreshment station later, when rainy weather would render any gunpowder for Dutch rifles useless. Sometime in July of 1659, Shimon was shepherding the livestock for the Dutch refreshment post. All of a sudden, another band of natives swarmed Shimon. They stabbed him to death. Then they herded away 68 cattle and 67 sheep. Van Riebeck had had enough. The commander called up local soldiers and settlers who killed three tribesmen in a skirmish. It wasn't until June 1660 that Van Riebeck finalized a peace agreement with the neighboring tribesmen. The agreement fixed a border and points of entry for both sides. But what were the Dutch doing in South Africa in the 1650s? It all started with a shipwreck.
Under the British flag, you will have everything you desire. But that flag will continue to fly over the land.
Over the land, maybe. Over the people, never. You will see me in the field, fighting for our independence, long after you and your party who make war with your mouths have fled the country.
I don't think the Boers will have a chance.
Disarm your blacks. Act the part of a white man in a white man's war.
Civilized war is awful.
The Nieuwe Haarlem went high and dry on March 25th, 1647, near present-day Blauwberg, just north of the Salt River mouth. Fortunately, the crew members and even much of the cargo escaped the shipwrecked vessel. Unfortunately, Leendert Jantz and 62 other crew members could not fit aboard another vessel that was returning to the Netherlands. So for a year, they waited. They were safely home in 1649. In a report to the Dutch East India Company, known as the VOC for short, Jantz and another crew member argued that a permanent refreshment station ought to be set up for the ship traffic and commercial trading stations. The natives peaceful, the Table Bay soil arable, and the trade climate receptive to the Dutch language. The VOC approved. Van Riebeck arrived to Table Bay with three ships, the Dromedaris, Hoedewoop, and Rather in 1652. You see, Van Riebeck was the first commander of this first Cape refreshment post. The post's purpose? To supply company ships. Its inhabitants were ordered to build a fort, but expected to keep peace with the natives and visitors from other nations. In the United States of America, we often associate multi-year contracts with millionaire athletes. Multi-year contracts were not typically for wealthy Dutchmen. Employees of the Dutch East India Company, the VOC, would work on contracts overseas for 5 or more years. After serving their multi-year contracts, VOC employees were able to become free burgers, people who could freely contract their services or sell their excess food to the VOC, natives, or any other buyers. At first, these burgers were primarily German or Dutch. These farmers and their white offspring would eventually be referred to as Boers. Boer was the Dutch word for farmer. Ironically, Commander Van Riebeck didn't see natives as physically suitable for harvesting company crops. So he first tried to employ sailors from visiting ships as temporary guest workers. When this didn't meet the labor demand, Van Riebeck received permission to import, you guessed it, slaves beginning in 1658. The first slaves arrived from Angola and Guinea. Eventually, people were imported from Madagascar and Asia. All were expected to learn Dutch. All were severely punished if they tried to escape. Some slaves, or their children at least, were eventually emancipated, creating a minority class in Cape society, known as the Free Blacks. Then, another religious minority was persecuted to the point of emigrating, more than once. King Louis XIV of France revoked the Edict of Nantes in 1685. He robbed French Protestants known as Huguenots of their religious freedom, thus causing thousands of them to flee to the more tolerant Netherlands. Between 1688 and 1692, the VOC contracted 200 of these Huguenots to boost the Cape's burgher population. This increased the population of this European cocktail of Dutch, German, and French settlers to 856. These Huguenots founded the wine industry of the Cape Colony and helped boost agricultural production in the colony. In 1699, a new governor inherited the Cape Colony. He took advantage of his position and power in a way that embittered the free burghers. He brought the burghers to a boil when it appeared that he had handpicked the man who would run the Cape wine monopoly. Adoum Tas and some other burghers complained about the governor's misuse of power by sending a petition to the VOC's Executive Council in 1705. The governor tried to clear his name and round up leaders of the burgher protest. The governor arrested Adoum Tas and threw some other burghers into the infamous Dark Hole in Cape Town's castle. When word reached the Cape that the VOC had set up a commission of inquiry on February 20, 1707, the burghers celebrated. For the first time, evidence of burghers identifying as something other than Dutch, French, or German, or a company man, emerged during a beating. On March 4th, a local magistrate beat 16-year-old Hendrik Bibow for his unruly shouting in the streets. An eyewitness reported Hendrik shouting, quote, "I will not back down. I am an Afrikaner. Even if the magistrate beats me to death or throws me into jail, I shall not be silenced," end quote. The VOC forced the governor, his deputy, his magistrate, and his minister of religion to resign in response to the widespread burgher protests. The disgraced officials left for the Netherlands in April 1708, permanently. Skirmishes were the exception, not the rule, between burghers and natives early on. Even the skirmishes led to relatively few deaths. Native populations around the burghers dwindled for a variety of reasons. The most deadly dwindler of native populations will ring some bells: disease. Sometimes disease struck cattle. However, entire native tribes were annihilated in 1713, 1755, and 1767 by smallpox. Native grip over communal holdings weakened. Their traditional lifestyles gradually waned. Their freedom sacrificed for food. Some natives were allowed to worship the Christian God with their employers. The Cape authorities forbade at least one missionary from administering sacraments to natives in 1742. But Christian mission stations started to sprout up towards the end of the 1700s. Burghers allowed detribalized natives to bear arms to help protect against predators, thieves, and enemies. The VOC had very few soldiers to defend its garrison, so creating a kind of militia, a commando system, was crucial. Burghers, free blacks, and natives served on local commandos. Cape Town featured its own bastard corps. Yes, the corps bastard Hottentotten, a 400-man contingent of ethnically mixed natives, was formed in 1781, establishing a long tradition of professional military service by natives. The deeper into southern Africa's interior the burghers allowed their cattle to graze, the more they were confronted with the Bushmen. The Bushmen were the closest descendants of the earliest humans that inhabited southern Africa. The VOC's company officials referred to these natives as Bushmen because of their tendency to hide from strangers behind bushes. The Bushmen were hunters, but some of their best hunting land was being pushed into by burghers and the burghers' native allies. The Bushmen tried in vain to prevent penetration. They also would steal burgher livestock. Clashes between commandos and Bushmen would interrupt many periods of negotiated peace. Imagine that you're guarding your boss's cattle when all of a sudden you're struck in the foot with an arrow. You take cover and frantically scan the horizon, grateful that you are lucky enough to only be shot in the foot. In what seems like an eternity, you finally see one very short African tribesman trying to flank you from the left. You fire with your rifle, hitting the tribesman in the head. Just then another arrow strikes you in the shoulder. You drop to the ground and reload. You're an exceptional marksman. You turn around just in time to drop the other short Bushman rushing upon you with another arrow drawn. Feelings of relief and triumph fill you. You scan the horizon again for several minutes, but there is no one else. You feel fortuitous again because you're able to pull both arrows cleanly out of your body. You find help, hopeful that you'll be restored. You're dead, before the next day's sunrise. You see, the arrows that struck you were tipped with lethal poison. That's how Bushmen arrows were. Between 1786 and 1795, Bushmen stole thousands of cattle and killed 276 herd boys and farmers in the process. The burghers were not just on the defensive, though. For example, one commando operation in 1774 killed 503 Bushmen and captured 241 women and children. By the 1790s, Bushmen evacuated north to an area that would eventually become the Orange Free State. Remaining Bushmen made peace with the Cape authorities in 1798. The Cape Colony's burghers also clashed with the neighboring Xhosa. Sorry, I can't do the click at the beginning there. The Cape Colony's burghers also clashed with the neighboring Xhosa tribe, even after both agreed to the Great Fish River as their border. They would fight three frontier wars in just the last 20 years of the 18th century. Several more frontier wars were to come. By 1800, few burghers were willing to plow their own land. Like many economies around the world, the Cape Colonies was built on slavery. 63,000 slaves were imported to the Cape Colony by the time the British outlawed the slave trade in 1808. The VOC itself kept around 500 slaves into the 18th century. Burgher-owned slaves, on the other hand, enjoyed better clothing and education. If the slaves spoke Dutch, they were granted the honor of wearing a hat, though they typically worked barefoot. Slaves from West Africa were very strong, while slaves from India and Indonesia were often skilled craftsmen, while Cape-born slaves could be counted on most not to run away. Slave owners freed their slaves less than 1% of the time. Early on, slaves were allowed to worship the Christian God with their owner's family, but 1721 came. A 1721 ordinance banned slaves from getting their children baptized. This helped spark a growing trend towards barring slaves from Christian churches. What if you were a slave born to a German, Dutch, or French father? You and your mother were still at risk of being sold. That is, until 1775. Beginning in 1775, you and your mother had to be emancipated after your owner's death. While this was great, you as a half-caste struggled to belong anywhere. You and about 2,000 others made up this class of baptized free blacks. You had to serve in a commando to fight against Bushmen. You didn't marry natives and almost certainly didn't marry whites. You married within your small class of free blacks unless you were a free black woman. With there being such a shortage of white women in the Cape Colony, many doctors, sailors, government officials, and other burghers married free black women. Still, many free blacks wanted their own society. Adam Cook, a freed slave, led a group of free blacks north near the Harif River. This group eventually became known as the Griqua by 1813. They lived much like the later Four Trekkers as farmers with livestock, ever watchful of the frontier. They and their land will reemerge later in our story. The Reformed Church stood as a pillar of Cape Colony society from the beginning. The VOC explicitly ordered that church be established at the Cape Refreshing Station. The VOC meticulously vetted, selected, and paid all 45 ministers who pastored in the Cape Colony. The colony extended religious freedom not only to the German Lutherans, the Roman Catholics, and the Protestant Huguenots, but also allowed Muslim slaves and other Asians in the colony to practice their own religion. The church did run the Cape schools into the 19th century, since one of the main purposes of schools was to empower people to read their Bibles and master their theology. Reverend H.R. Fonlier helped spark spiritual revival in 1788, which laid the groundwork for more sustained, systematic efforts by Moravian missionaries to convert slaves and nearby natives. Now let me answer a question none of you asked. Who is the first true hero of the Cape Colony? Let me tell you about June 1st, 1773. You see, another ship ran aground near the mouth of the Salt River on this day. A violent storm drove the De Jong Thomas and its 203 passengers into a sandbank, and the storm still raged on. All the Dutch East India Company soldiers thought they could do was stand helplessly and guard any supplies that washed ashore from the ship. Then, a poor elderly dairy farmer named Volrod Voltimade stepped up to do what no one else would. Volrod couldn't watch the ship be helplessly heaved into the storm. Volrod rode his white horse into the surging waves. He brought two passengers aboard his horse and brought them to shore. He did this again, and again, and again, and again, and again, and again, and... After rescuing 14 people, Volrod returned to the ship an eighth time. Volrod's son was standing guard on the beach the entire time, watching this all happen. But when Volrod returned to the ship an eighth time, not two, not four, but six people panicked and leapt onto his horse. They, Volrod, and the horse fell beneath the waves, never to breathe again. Soon after, the ship disintegrated in the storm. Only 53 of the remaining 183 passengers made it ashore, holding on to wreckage for dear life. What made Volrod even more heroic? When he ventured into the storm to save 14 people, Volrod knew he couldn't swim. Less than a decade after Volrod's heroics, the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War broke out from 1780 to 1784. The French, of all nations, sent two regiments to fortify the Cape garrison that suddenly saw surges in shipping traffic. Cape Town eventually was nicknamed Little Paris as the outpost grew richer. This French intervention would cause a ripple that would transform into crashing waves in a decade's time. The Patriots would also make long-term ripples. This group of burghers grew sick of VOC economic restrictions and erupted when the company tried to raise taxes and pare down local Cape autonomy. Patriot resistance grew to the point that districts across the Cape colony formally rejected VOC rule in 1795. Some patriots offered their assent only to the States General, the ruling body of the Netherlands. That same month, that June of 1795, Admiral George Keith Elphinstone, with his large British fleet, and Major General James Craig commanding the British soldiers aboard, landed at the Cape Colony. The French had recently started ruling the Netherlands. These British arrived on Cape shores, assuring the local burgher council that they were only there temporarily, to protect against the threat of French conquering the Cape Colony. September reinforcements sealed the surrender of the local burgher leadership. VOC rule replaced with British rule. This British rule lasted only until the Treaty of Amiens, which, among a lot of other moving parts, granted the new Netherlands government control of the Cape Colony in 1802. This new government moved control of schools to the state, spelling equal educational opportunities for all burghers, regardless of religious denomination. The new government incorporated much more local control into the Cape Colony until the British invaded again in January 1806. This British force drove the colony to surrender in less than 2 weeks. As the Industrial Revolution continued, the demand for raw materials and secure markets increased. The Cape Colony became crucial to the British as a rest stop en route to India and other British trade posts in Asia. The Cape Colony was also crucial because natural harbors on the African coast were rare. British control of the Cape's harbors along Table Bay and Simon's Bay meant that other European powers didn't get these harbors. The British gathered consistent intelligence from a variety of sources during their first 1795 to 1803 occupation of the Cape Colony. The intelligence indicated a strong existing infrastructure and valuable human resources. As soon as the British had secured Bloor's surrender to British control in 1806, the British immediately set to work making the colony more efficient and putting local, British-friendly Bloors in charge. There was one proclamation that would see many variations and resurrections over the next 170 years. This 1809 proclamation required every local native to have a permanent place of residence and to carry a pass, a written letter of permission, with them whenever they traveled to the other parts of the Cape Colony. The stated purpose of the pass was to limit theft and vagrancy. The result of this proclamation, local natives were much more dependent on their employers and had much less freedom and status. These natives could find opportunities for improved status by joining the military. Two Irishmen, James Hooper and Michael Kelly, encouraged two slaves to do a dangerous but relatively nonviolent thing after all was said and done. On October 27, 1808, Louis and Abraham gathered 331 fellow slaves from 34 farms and marched towards Cape Town's local authorities to demand their freedom. Along the way, they seized wagons, saddled horses, firearms, and the personal belongings of two Boers. Cape Governor Caledon sent a cavalry division that the marchers immediately surrendered to without any resistance. James Hooper, the Irishman, and Abraham, the slave leader, were executed with three others. Nearly 100 others received a beating or short jail sentence. The slave revolt was a failure, but the French Revolution and the Enlightenment's ripples converged enough in 1815 to cause tighter, more humane regulation of slavery in the Cape Colony and around the British Empire. The Boers resented British rule by default, but this tighter taxation and regulation of slavery embittered some Boers enough to send them trickling further north out of the Cape Colony. 4,000 British immigrants arrived at the Cape Colony in 1820. This brought the colony's population to 46,000. Within 2 years, Lord Charles Somerset announced a three-step schedule to Anglicize the Cape Colony. As part of this plan, English would become the official language of the colony by 1823. This language issue will recur in later episodes. Abolitionist proponents in British Parliament forced a further blow to the Boer way of life in August of 1833. This time, British Parliament went beyond merely abolishing the slave trade. They went after slavery itself. Slavery was officially prohibited across the British Empire effective December 1834. Famous abolitionist William Wilberforce died just 3 days after he heard about this act passing British Parliament. As a transition, slaves were to work a 4-year apprenticeship for their masters. Their masters would be compensated for their slaves, but far below the market value of the slave. Cynicism and rage rose among Boer slave owners when they also found they could only get their compensation in London. Many Boers decided enough was enough at this point, and so began the Great Trek, a trek made more feasible by 9 frontier wars against the powerful Xhosa tribe. British soldiers, Cape Burghers, and British tribal allies had already worn down the Xhosa in 6 of these wars before. Thousands of Boers began booking it over the Cape border. The Boers trekked across the Orange River deeper into southern Africa's interior. From 1836 to 1845, approximately 14,000 migrant Boers, or four trekkers, took their livestock, belongings, and slaves with them. To counter this loss, British Parliament passed the Cape of Good Hope Punishment Act of 1836, proclaiming British jurisdiction over territory up to the 25 degrees south latitude line. This line runs through present-day Namibia, Botswana, and Mozambique, and through territory that would become the Transvaal. The four trekkers, on the other hand, clashed with tribes in their path, in the land that they believed God had given them, his modern-day Israelites. Many, many historians argued that these Afrikaners saw the Africans in their path as descendants of Ham, as the heathen God had chosen the Boers to drive out or beat into submission. However, some historians, like André Dutoit, argue that there is very little evidence that Afrikaners generally embraced and espoused this chosen people belief. As Cape Colony forces drove the Xhosa tribe deeper into Africa through frontier war after frontier war, there was a greater force at work, Umfakane. The literal Zulu meaning for Umfakane is the hammering or the crushing. Let's try to understand Umfakane by first identifying its results. The force of Umfakane changed the lives of scores of African tribes in at least 3 ways. First, the large number of small chiefdoms were consolidated into fewer, larger kingdoms. Second, these larger kingdoms focused even more on improving and wielding their militaries. Third, the ethnic and linguistic map of southern Africa shifted dramatically. To tell the stories of all the dozens of tribes in southern Africa would take too long, and I would do those stories an injustice. Instead, we will highlight a couple stories that illustrate how the force of Umfakane worked and how it helped set the stage for the Boer Wars. We will start by introducing you to a boy who was mercilessly bullied for the size of his penis. Shaka Zulu was born in 1787. He was extraordinary. His father, chief of the Zulu, a much smaller tribe of only 4,000 to 5,000 people during Shaka's childhood. As a preteen, Shaka was bullied and coerced by older children into catching boiling hot food in his hands and eating that food. Shaka was mocked. The other boys mock Shaka for his crinkled ears and his small penis. Zulu oral tradition reports that Shaka grew up harboring a deadly hatred. Shaka first distinguished himself as a cadet in the tribal school that initiated 15 to 16-year-old boys into manhood through military training. Shaka stood out from his class of boys, his regiment. After his father died, murder and intrigue ensued, with Shaka eventually emerging as the sole leader of the Zulu. The Zulu were in a loose confederation of tribes at the time. The death of the confederation's leader paved the way for Shaka to take more iron control of this confederation. When Shaka beat the armies of over 100 chiefdoms into subservience or large-scale emigration, surviving members of those chiefdoms were incorporated into the Zulu Confederation and its army. This absorption perfectly exemplifies all the aspects of Umfukane. In fact, Zulu is currently the largest single ethnic identity in South Africa. The flight of tribes escaping the Zulu orbit also exemplifies Umfukane perfectly. The Lozi Kingdom of current-day Western Zambia was established by members of the Sotho Kingdom, who traveled 1,000 miles away from their close proximity to the Zulu. One of Shaka's lieutenants mutinied and took hundreds of his followers away from Zulu territory to form a Zulu-like kingdom in southwestern Zimbabwe. This mutinous group became the Undebele Kingdom. Shaka never married and fathered no children. At age 41, Shaka was assassinated on September 24, 1828, by a group of people that included at least one half-brother. Why did the crushing, Umfukane, happen? What caused dozens of these tribes to crash against each other, absorb each other, or disperse, even before, in many cases, white people fought them? There are at least three theories with varying levels of evidence. Number one, trade in Delagoa Bay caused competition for access to goods for import among tribes. Two, seasons of drought driving people to migrate and compete for limited resources. Three, less credibly, the slave trade driving tribes inward. During and after the crushing, four trekkers were embarking on the aforementioned Great Trek. Hundreds, possibly thousands of Undebele attacked Andries Potgieter's party that included the future South African Republic's president, Paul Kruger. 36 grown men, along with Kruger and the boys, fired rifles again and again and again during this half-hour attack. Around 400 Undebele fell, compared to only two Fuhr trekkers. 6 weeks later, a large gathering of these and other Fuhr trekkers held their first gathering where they elected their first 7-man burgher council. Potgieter's party would lead a retaliatory raid and looting of an Ndebele dwelling the next year with the help of 100 nearby natives. Pete Retief led another group of Fuhr trekkers that would eventually link up with Potgieter's group. Without consulting the Fuhr trekkers' elected leadership, the Retief led a small party to meet Dingaan, chief of the Zulu, in February 1838. This would not end well. Ignoring local warnings that Dingaan was plotting against his party, the Retief met twice at the Zulu headquarters to negotiate a treaty that would cede some Zulu land to the Boers. There were many presumptive missteps and misunderstandings leading up to these treaty negotiations that made Dingaan distrust the whites. But the treaty was signed, and Retief and his men were invited to bid the king farewell. As was the customs, the Fuhr trekkers drank beer and watched a group of Zulu warriors perform a traditional dance, while unarmed. Suddenly, all the Fuhr trekkers were dragged to a nearby hill and murdered. Dingaan then sent a surprise attack against the Retief's remaining men and families of the Retief's Fuhr trekkers. The Fuhr trekkers who survived these attacks and Fuhr trekkers further away would clash with the Zulu repeatedly and repeatedly watch their Boer leaders perish. But then Andries Pretorius and his group of Fuhr trekkers met up with the Fuhr trekker Laher near Zululand. Pretorius laid a plan to take the fight to Zululand. On December 9, 1838, his commando made a vow. If God led them to victory over the Zulu, these Boers and their descendants would commemorate their day of victory each year. More than 10,000 Zulu crashed in waves against the Fuhr trekkers' circle of wagons, the Boer Laher, on December 16, 1838, in what would be remembered as the Battle of Blood River. More people died in this single battle than almost any in South African history. About 500 Boers held off the Zulu. None of the Boers perished. 3,000 Zulu lay dead. the Zulu Kingdom contracted. The Battle of Blood River gave birth to the Republic of Natal, with borders based on the Retief-Dingaan Treaty, the treaty signed by a now-dead Boer leader and a retreating Zulu king. The colony formed its own elected Volksraad of 24 members. Neither the British nor the Netherlands recognized this new colony. Less than 5 years later, British troops occupied Port Natal and hoisted the Union Jack, the British flag. After a few months of resistance, the Republic surrendered to British rule. Natal would become a separate district of the Cape Colony in May 1844. The British continued intervening elsewhere in the southern African interior by creating a new post of High Commissioner for Southern Africa. The British set up this vaguely defined authority in 1846 to offer protection to any native chiefs being harassed by the Boers. The British asserted themselves the most in February 1848 when they established the Orange River Sovereignty, an area between the Drakensberg Mountains, Orange River, and Fall River. The Transvaal Boers interfered much in the Orange River Sovereignty, which caused a fight between the Transvaalers and the British on August 29, 1848 at the Battle of Boomplatz. British victory did nothing to stop the Transvaal Boers from trying to destabilize the Orange River sovereignty again. For reasons we will cover in other episodes, the British decided sinking more troops into this area was not the answer. The British and the Transvaalers came to the negotiating table. They hammered out the Sand River Convention and ratified it on January 17, 1852. The Transvaal Boers promised to stay out of the Orange River sovereignty's business. The British recognized the Transvaal Boers' independence. The British also agreed not to ally with any of the colored nations north of the Fall River. The British also promised to keep the flow of ammunition and Cape migrants open to the South African Republic. The major concession these Boers made, they had to abolish slavery. These Boers established the new nation, the South African Republic. Just 2 years later, the British also let go of the Orange River sovereignty in the Bloemfontein Convention. On February 23, 1854, the Orange River sovereignty became the Orange Free State under similar terms as the South African Republic. 9 years later, the British revoked the act that had earlier declared their jurisdiction up to the 25 degrees south line of latitude. The image of the Laager, the circle of Voor Trekker wagons, resonates through South African history. As the Voor Trekkers press deeper into southern Africa, they are confronted by far more numerous natives. Even after the Voor Trekkers established colonies, they were surrounded by tribes far more numerous. And even today, through all of South Africa's often tragic history, Afrikaners, South Africa's original whites, are outnumbered by 20 to 1 by all of the nation's other ethnicities. Now that the show is over, I want to give an unsolicited shout-out to my friend and award-winning professor, Elizabeth Warren. You did such a good job teaching us and modeling for us what tremendous, gripping storytelling is. You also generously gave many office hours as I tried to wrap my head and my heart around storytelling. I hope you see the difference you've made in at least some of the narrative in this and future episodes. I also want to give a disclaimer and an apology for those of you who haven't already listened to episodes 1 and 2 from start to finish. My first disclaimer. I'm an American. Therefore, even with my best efforts and a couple South African and British friends generously coaching me on pronunciations, I'm sure I will still butcher some names, especially where any rolling of R's is involved. Just know that it's my fault, that I'm doing the best I can, and that you're welcome to email me at forgottenwarspodcast@gmail.com if you have any pronunciation corrections. And you know what? Email me any constructive suggestions for how I can improve the show. Anyone who knows me knows that I appreciate constructive feedback over flattery any day. Email me about any historical inaccuracies you think came out of my mouth. I do research each episode quite a bit, but I doubt I will get through dozens of episodes without making even one mistake. If you do email me about anything you think is inaccurate, please provide me a specific citation, ideally with page numbers, not just read this book. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. You're one of my favorite types of listeners. I hope you'll tune in again.
So there you have it. That's the end of the Forgotten Wars first podcast. And now I hope you've enjoyed it. And if you want to subscribe to Michael's show, then by all means, I'm going to leave a link in the description below so you know where to find it. Now, on to my stuff. So next week, we're going to be looking at the Rise of the Chin. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about how the Qin unified China, or what was China at the time, and then we'll talk about the policies that Qin Shi Huang implemented when he became emperor. So stay tuned for that, and I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you next time on the Chronicler podcast channel. Thanks for listening.